He knocked like a cop, spoke like one, wore the badge, drove the SUV. But behind the silicone mask was no officer. Just a man with a kill list, a Bible twisted into a weapon, and 70 names marked for execution. In just 90 minutes, two were dead. Two more barely survived. And the state of Minnesota descended into its most terrifying manhunt in history. I'm Claire Thompson, an investigative journalist. And this is the true story of how Vance Luther Bolter manipulated trust, religion, and routine into a weapon of political assassination. All while the system watched in silence. This isn't just a story about one killer. It's about a movement, a mask, and the America we no longer recognize. You don't need an army to start a war. You just need a knock at the door. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The knock at the door. It started with a knock. Not a bang, not a scream. Just a knock, soft, deliberate. Around 2 a.m. on June 14, 2025, at a quiet home in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. The kind of knock you get from someone official. Someone you open the door for. Inside that house were Melissa Hortman, age 55, former Speaker of the Minnesota House of Representatives, and her husband, Mark, age 58. Both were awake. Both were used to late calls, political emergencies, campaign volunteers, the occasional knock from local police. They lived a public life, and this wasn't the first time someone came to the door late at night, but it would be the last. On the other side of the door stood a man who looked like a tactical officer. Full dark gear, utility vest, heavy boots. His SUV was parked out front, dark colored, tinted, with red and blue police lights flickering behind the grill. It was marked police. He had a badge. A radio. Even his face, calm, hardened, looked like a career officer. But it wasn't a face. It was a mask. Hyperrealistic silicone. Meant to deceive. And it worked. Melissa answered the door. In seconds, she was dead. Shot point blank. Mark followed. Shot just steps behind her. The house lights flickered on, motion sensors triggered. A neighbor saw the vehicle idle, then disappear silently into the dark suburban streets. By the time police arrived, it was too late. There were no demands, no warning, no manifesto. Just two bodies. And a scene so calculated, it didn't feel like rage. It felt like precision. And that's what chilled us all. My name is Claire Thompson. I'm a journalist based in the Midwest. I've covered political scandals, extremist plots, and more than one cold case. But when I was sent to cover this, I didn't realize at first that I wasn't just following a killer. I was following a manipulator. Vance Luther Bolter, 57 years old. Not a drifter. Not a gang member. Not a disgruntled employee. A former church leader. A self-styled security consultant. A man who claimed to walk with God and carry a badge. And yet whose only real calling was control. He didn't just pull a trigger. He pulled strings for years. He wore a police costume not to hide, but to weaponize trust. He used a mask not to escape, but to become whoever he needed to be. And he built a hit list, dozens of names, by exploiting data brokers, voter registries, and digital footprints. He stalked his targets like prey, not because he knew them personally, but because they represented ideas he was taught to hate. It wasn't spontaneous. He had been planning this, building up to it, slowly and methodically. The vehicle he used was fitted with replica lights and plates. The weapons he carried, a 9mm Glock and AK-style rifles, were organized, maintained, and stored with military-like discipline. And in the passenger seat, a notebook. Names. Addresses. Notes on habits. Time logs. Red check marks. It was a kill list, made by a man who wanted to feel like law and order, but in truth was chaos wrapped in authority. This wasn't just about ideology. It was about manipulation on every level. Physical, emotional, visual, psychological. That first knock on Melissa Hortman's door was more than an act of violence. It was the beginning of a political assassination campaign unlike anything Minnesota had ever seen. A domestic terror spree carefully disguised as official duty. And when I began piecing together what happened next, from Champlin to Green Isle, it became painfully clear. Bolter didn't just want to kill. He wanted to be believed. He wanted the system to trust him long enough to open its doors, so he could walk through and burn it from the inside. What follows in this investigation is not just a story of murder. It's a story of manufactured authority, of information weaponized, of a country whose systems can be exploited by someone who understands the rules and bends them until they break. I'll take you through it. Every house he visited, every step he took, every name on that list. Because the truth isn't in the blood he spilled. It's in the mask he wore. Chapter 2, The Man in the Silicone Mask. You don't forget a face like that. That's what one witness told me. He lived three houses down from the Hortmans in Brooklyn Park. Said he saw the figure at a distance, illuminated briefly by a motion sensor light near the front porch. Tall, broad-shouldered, black tactical gear, a radio on the chest, even a badge glinting under the light. But what struck him most was the face. Too perfect, he said, like a mannequin. No muscle movement, just blank. The face wasn't real. Police confirmed days later that Vance Bolter had worn a hyper-realistic silicone mask, the kind used in special effects departments or covert operations. Seamless edges, pores and wrinkles airbrushed to mimic human skin. Eyelashes individually applied. Expression neutral, slightly stern. A face designed for one thing, believability. But here's what chilled me. This mask wasn't store-bought. It was customized. The make and model traced back to an underground supplier known for discreet orders. No facial hair, no ethnic ambiguity, just a generic authority look, calculated to fall into that subconscious space where people instinctively obey. Because the mask wasn't about disguise. It was about manipulation. Bolter knew that people don't look closely under pressure. That in the dead of night, if you flash a badge, wear a uniform, and keep your voice low and assertive, most will comply. And he prepared for that moment. He had the SUV modified months in advance. Blacked out windows. Unregistered plates. Red and blue LED light bars hidden behind the grill. Police decals printed with professional vinyl. He even programmed a police-style dispatch tone to play through his Bluetooth speaker. Chatter and all. It was theater. Not rage. Not spontaneity. Theater. A performance of power designed to override instinct. Because once you answer the door, your brain does the rest. The uniform says authority. The gear says trust. The mask says normal. And by the time your gut tells you something's off, it's too late. That's what Melissa Hortman and her husband faced that night. They didn't see a killer. They saw law enforcement. A man who looked right. And that visual manipulation, that blend of costume, posture, and silence, is what made Bolter so dangerous. He didn't yell. He didn't force entry. He knocked. He waited. He let you open the door. He made you participate. In the days that followed, I spoke with digital forensics teams and behavioral analysts assigned to the case. They described Bolter as obsessively rehearsed, not just operationally, but psychologically. His social media was scrubbed. His digital footprint light. He ran prep drills in rural areas, observed on traffic cams weeks prior, testing how people reacted to his outfit when he knocked on random doors and claimed to be checking on disturbance reports. No one questioned him. They all let him leave. This is what I want you to understand. Bolter didn't just manipulate individuals. He manipulated a system of perception. He understood how we respond to symbols, a badge, a voice, a face of calm authority. And he used that knowledge to dismantle trust from within. A kind of social engineering executed in real time, backed by real weapons. And what's worse, he almost didn't need the mask. Several people told police later that they might not have noticed if it had slipped, if it was off slightly. They were too stunned by the lights, too disarmed by his posture, by the word police, which raises a deeper question. One I wrestled with as I reconstructed those early hours. How much of our safety depends on recognizing real from fake? And how easily can that be hacked? Because Bolter didn't break in. He wasn't some shadowy figure lurking in the woods. He stood under porch lights in full view, knocked politely, waited for someone to trust him. And when they did, he ended their lives. This wasn't chaos. It was choreography. And the mask, that face we now know wasn't his, became the most haunting image of all. Not just because it covered a killer, but because it revealed something darker. That sometimes, manipulation doesn't come through lies or threats. It comes through familiarity. It comes wearing a badge. It comes in the form of help. And we invite it in. Chapter 3, Target List, 70 Names to Die For. When authorities searched Vance Bolter's vehicle after his arrest, they expected weapons. maybe tactical maps, maybe something crude and paranoid, like a manifesto scrawled in blood-red ink. What they found was worse. It was organized, a three-ring binder, dozens of pages, handwritten notes, names, ages, addresses, occupations, side details, where people worked, where their children went to school, what kind of cars they drove, when they usually arrived home. It was alphabetical, cross-referenced by city and political affiliation. Some names were circled in red ink. Others had time windows. A few had notations like no dog or lives alone. There were 70 names in total. Most were Democratic politicians, both local and federal. But it didn't stop there. Pro-choice doctors, LGBTQ plus activists, journalists, healthcare administrators, a few clergy members, one librarian. It wasn't just political. It was ideological and personal. Investigators called it a kill list. I call it a map of manipulated hate, because Bolter didn't know most of these people. He hadn't met them. They hadn't wronged him. But he built this list over months, possibly years, by scraping online directories, campaign sites, public service databases, and leaked voter registration info from data brokers. Think about that. You can buy someone's full name, email, cell number, address history, political affiliation, and even household size for under $3 from certain online brokers. All legal, all publicly accessible. And Vance Luther Bolter used that system like a sniper uses a scope. He wasn't searching for opportunity. He was building intention. Each entry told a story. Melissa Hortman, former speaker, underlined twice, followed by media appearances equals risk. State Senator John Hoffman, soft target, has garage. Midnight lights equals off. An OBGYN in Duluth, aborts third trimester, says so online. A nonprofit director, LGBTQ safe space grant funded. To him, these weren't just people. They were symbols. He wasn't targeting personalities. He was targeting beliefs, beliefs he was taught to fear, to hate, to see as threats to faith, family, and the nation he thought was being taken from him. The list also showed intent that went beyond the emotional. He didn't just plan to confront. He planned to execute. Swiftly. At their homes, where their guards were down. With no warning. Just the knock. Just the badge. Just the shot. This was not a mass shooter in the traditional sense. This was an assassin. And the more I studied that list, the more I saw the manipulation not just in how he dressed or knocked, but in how he dehumanized. He turned people into data points, values to be corrected, threats to be neutralized. He reduced real lives to one-line arguments. Abortionist, woke mayor, socialist, drag queen councilman, labels he didn't invent, but absorbed from the echo chambers he fed on. Bolter's worldview wasn't born in isolation. It was fed by disinformation loops online. Religious fundamentalism twisted into militarism. Conspiracy channels that promised holy war and coded language that cast violence as righteousness. He didn't arrive at these ideas on his own. He was led there by voices that told him Democrats weren't opponents, they were demons. That abortion doctors weren't medical professionals, they were murderers. That LGBTQ teachers weren't educators, they were groomers. That journalists weren't storytellers, they were enemies of the state. And once you believe that, a kill list feels like justice, not extremism. That's the most terrifying kind of manipulation. Not the one that tricks you into doing something, but the one that convinces you it was your calling all along. By the time Bolter finished that list, he had convinced himself that murder wasn't murder. It was ministry. So when he knocked on those doors, one hand on a gun, the other holding a badge, he wasn't just hunting. He thought he was cleansing. I looked over that list at the state evidence building, page after page, name after name, and I realized how easily any of us could have been on it. Not because of who we are, but because of what someone else believes about us. Because that's how manipulation works. It doesn't have to be true. It just has to feel right to the wrong person. Chapter 4, Inside the Radical Machine. To understand what Vance Luther Bolter did, you have to understand what he believed. But more than that, you have to understand how he came to believe it. He didn't wake up one morning and decide to assassinate lawmakers. That kind of extremism doesn't fall from the sky. It's built, layer by layer, one manipulated message at a time. And Bolter, like many before him, was groomed, not by a single person, but by an entire ecosystem of radicalization. He called himself a Christian patriot. He wasn't a soldier, not officially, not in any branch of the U.S. military, but he dressed the part, posed with tactical rifles, wore camouflage vests, posted scripture beside Second Amendment memes. At one point, he led a small home-based evangelical group, not affiliated with any formal church, where he delivered sermons about spiritual warfare and righteous judgment. Members say he quoted scripture, but twisted it. That's where it started, a perversion of purpose, turning forgiveness into vengeance, mercy into control. He didn't just read the Bible, he weaponized it, but religion was only part of the machine. His online activity filled in the rest. Bolter was active in at least four encrypted message boards tied to Christian nationalism and anti-government conspiracy. These were not mainstream forums. These were dark corners of the internet, behind firewalls, password protected, moderated by pseudonymous hosts who encouraged violence under the veil of divine justification. One of those groups, based on federal investigation, was linked to three other domestic terror plots over the last 5 years. On those forums, Bolter didn't rant. He planned. He listened. He downloaded maps, blueprints, arrest evasion strategies. They shared videos of cop cosplay, tutorials on how to mimic real officers without breaking impersonation laws. Some even had threads titled The Knock Test. How to speak, where to stand, how to hold your body like a trained responder. Bolter was a student, and the more he learned, the more radical he became. In 2024, he began posting under a new alias, Crossfire Faith 77. He uploaded doctored videos of politicians he claimed were harboring satanic influence. He praised vigilante justice. He called for divine retribution on the wicked, and his engagement exploded. Dozens of replies, applause, encouragement, followers who called him a warrior of light. This is how the machine works. You start lonely, angry, aimless. You find a video, a thread, a quote out of context, and then you find others who agree. The algorithms deliver more. Your screen becomes a tunnel. Your world narrows. And suddenly the impossible, murder, terrorism, war, starts to feel inevitable, even holy. Bolter was groomed by a lie dressed in scripture. But what elevated him beyond online chatter was access. He had resources, money, property outside the metro area, multiple firearms purchased legally and illegally, tactical vests, flashbangs, gas masks, a modified SUV, and data, so much data, purchased through third-party brokers, scraped from social media, collected from campaign websites. He knew where people lived, when they voted, what they supported, and nobody stopped him. Not once. There were warnings. Former acquaintances say he talked about doing God's work through lead. One man even reported him to a local tip line in 2023. But nothing came of it. No follow-up. No red flag laws triggered. Because Bolter knew how to stay just inside the lines. How to manipulate systems as well as minds. This is what chills me most. He wasn't just a lone extremist. He was the end product of a much larger process. A radicalized American, molded by disinformation, online indoctrination, religious manipulation, and bureaucratic blind spots. And yet, he still wore a smile in the mask. That's what one forensic tech told me. When they peeled it off, the silicone face he used during the attacks, they found it molded with a slight upward curl around the mouth. Not a full grin, just enough to disarm. Enough to make you feel like the officer on your porch wasn't a threat, just a guy doing his job. It was all part of the act, an act rehearsed, programmed, and reinforced by a machine that doesn't need headquarters or hierarchy. Just a signal, a target, a trigger. Vance Bolter didn't act alone. He acted on command. He just couldn't tell you who gave it. Chapter 5, Shadow Surveillance. By the time Vance Bolter stepped onto Melissa Hortman's porch, he already knew everything about her. Where she lived, what time the porch lights went off, when her husband usually came back from work, what kind of car she drove, even which window stayed open at night. He didn't know her in any personal sense, but in a digital sense, he knew too much, because Bolter wasn't just a killer. He was a hunter, and his weapon wasn't just a firearm. It was information. What investigators found after his arrest painted a terrifying picture. Bolter had built a digital map of his targets using surveillance techniques that didn't require hacking, didn't require spy satellites, didn't even require technical brilliance. All it took was access and intent. Here's how it worked. First, data brokers. Bolter used publicly available services to purchase detailed personal profiles. The kind of data tech companies collect every time we open an app, swipe a loyalty card, or click accept cookies. Voter registration rolls. Property records. Email databases. GPS pings scraped from weather apps. A person's life, condensed into a spreadsheet. Melissa Hortman's address? $2.79 from a broker in Texas. State Senator John Hoffman's travel history? Reconstructed using anonymized GPS logs bought in bulk. A nurse practitioner from Duluth? Mapped using Facebook check-ins and a real estate listing from 2019. It wasn't illegal. That's what's so disturbing. The system worked exactly as designed, and Bolter exploited it with chilling precision. Second, social media patterns. He didn't have to break passwords. He just watched. Closely. Repetitively. He tracked target routines through tagged photos, retweets, story posts. He cross-referenced Instagram posts with Google Maps. Downloaded images to study door layouts. Monitored local Facebook groups for public events and likely absences. He even ran background checks on delivery schedules. Watched Amazon drop-offs to see who opened the door. Tracked garbage day. One neighbor confirmed Bolter had driven by her house at least 4 times in the weeks before the shootings, wearing different hats and parking just out of frame of her Ring camera. He was casing homes like a burglar, but with the long view of a military op. Third, online behavioral scraping. This is where it gets darker. Bolter accessed known leaks from major social platforms. Some of these were shared in far-right forums, full data dumps from previous hacks. He used scripts to scrape emails and cross-check logins with services like Have I Been Pwned? Then, if a target had used the same password on multiple sites, and some did, he'd gain access to calendar events, private posts, old messages. In one instance, he printed out a private family vacation photo taken from a hacked cloud folder. He marked the address on the back. That person never knew they were on the list. Until now, this wasn't surveillance in the traditional sense. This was shadow surveillance, digital stalking without detection. Low-tech, high-impact, done from a laptop in the quiet corners of Minnesota's rural edge. And it worked because the infrastructure was already there. Bolter didn't build a surveillance network. He simply stepped into one we all live inside. The manipulation wasn't just what he learned about his victims. It was what he made them feel, that no place was safe, that no life was private, that no home, no matter how suburban or quiet, was out of reach from a man who could wear a badge, speak calmly, and knock when you least expected it. That's the insidious power of this kind of manipulation. It doesn't need brute force. It needs familiarity. He weaponized routine. He weaponized our digital footprint. And he did it under the radar. No formal intelligence training, no hacking tools, no team. Just a man with time, intent, and the quiet rage to make people's personal lives into tactical vulnerabilities. As I traced his process, I began to see how close we all are to being exposed, not just by bad actors, but by the systems we trust. The same ones that remember your birthday, recommend your next movie, and offer location-based coupons can also put a gunman on your porch. Vance Bolter didn't need to break in. He was already inside. Chapter 6, The 90-Minute Terror Window. It began at 2:03 a.m. and ended at 3:32. 90 minutes. That's how long it took Vance Luther Bolter to carry out the most coordinated political attack Minnesota had ever seen. Not a random rampage. Not an explosion of rage. This was surgical. Calculated. A terror operation executed with eerie silence and mechanical rhythm. And during those 90 minutes, democracy bled. Bolter began in Brooklyn Park. His first targets, Melissa Hortman, former Speaker of the House, and her husband Mark. As we've covered, they never stood a chance. He rang the bell in uniform. Masked. Silent. Within seconds, both were down. No neighbors reported shouting. No security system went off. The SUV marked police. Disappeared quietly into the night. He had already pre-programmed his GPS with the next stop, Champlin. 14 minutes later, Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette were waking up to the same knock. They had just gone to bed. Yvette was still brushing her teeth when she heard it. Unlike the Hortmans, they didn't open the door immediately. Hoffman glanced through the peephole and noticed something odd. The uniform looked right, but the officer wasn't moving quite like one. That hesitation saved their lives. Bolter opened fire anyway. Through the glass. Through the walls. Hoffman was hit in the shoulder. Yvette in the leg. They scrambled down the hallway, bleeding, panicked. He fired 5 more shots, then retreated when the porch lights triggered. The senator's dog, a German shepherd, began barking wildly. That may have been the tipping point. Bolter backed off. A neighbor called 911, but by the time police arrived, Bolter was already gone. 35 minutes in. 2 homes. 4 victims. 2 fatalities. He wasn't done. At 2:55 a.m., Bolter pulled into a quiet cul-de-sac in Blaine. Another name on the list. A local pro-choice advocate who chaired a public health nonprofit. Her lights were off. Her car was gone. Out of town for a speaking engagement. He circled once. Parked. He knocked anyway. Surveillance footage later showed him standing on the porch for exactly 37 seconds before leaving. It wasn't random. It was ritual. A routine rehearsed so often it didn't matter whether someone answered. He was there to complete the loop. At 3:12 a.m., his SUV approached the home of a high-profile abortion clinic director in Maple Grove. But something went wrong. A patrol car, just blocks away, noticed the vehicle's unusual decals. The SUV slowed, then turned off its headlights. A brief, high-stakes standoff unfolded. Bolter pulled into a driveway, shut off the engine, and waited. The officer didn't engage immediately, not knowing whether this was a legitimate undercover vehicle or a threat. That hesitation gave Bolter time. He reversed, made a sharp turn, and vanished into a side street before backup arrived. The timeline stops there. At 3:32 a.m., all digital pings from Bolter's vehicle went dark. His burner phone disconnected from its signal tower. The license plate recognition cameras picked up nothing beyond that hour. The rest of the state slept through it. 90 minutes. 4 houses. Dozens of rounds fired. And a political hit list only partially executed. It wasn't until morning, when the news broke about the Hortmans, that the scope of the attack began to take shape. First responders in Champlin hadn't yet connected the dots. Blaine hadn't even reported a suspicious vehicle. The officer in Maple Grove had flagged the SUV, but at the time, it was still categorized as possible impersonation, not a known active shooter. The system didn't fail because it was weak. It failed because Bolter understood how to move between its cracks. He drove just below the speed limit, took suburban backroads, turned off his tracking devices, used cloned plates from a decommissioned municipal vehicle. And most importantly, he struck at an hour when trust was automatic and attention was at its lowest. That's the horror of the 90-minute window. Everything worked as intended, except reality. Dispatchers didn't connect the calls fast enough. Officers followed protocol. Citizens answered the door. Nobody was prepared for the idea that someone would impersonate the police to assassinate lawmakers in their homes while they slept. But Bolter was. He had prepared for it. And the only reason he didn't kill more that night was timing. The third house was empty. The fourth had a patrol nearby. Luck, not prevention. That night changed how I looked at time. Because 90 minutes doesn't feel long until you fill it with terror. Until you realize how many doors could have opened. How many lives hung in the balance between one red light and the next. And how easily he could have knocked again. Chapter 7, Caught in Green Isle. For 43 hours, Minnesota held its breath. The man who impersonated a police officer, who wore a silicone mask, who murdered a political leader and her husband, who wounded a state senator, who knocked on the doors of democracy with a loaded gun and a kill list in his front seat, had vanished. And no one knew where he would strike next. Authorities launched what became the largest coordinated manhunt in state history. State troopers, local police, FBI counterterrorism units, aerial search teams with thermal scanners, tip lines flooded with reports, some accurate, most not. A shelter-in-place alert was issued across multiple counties. Schools were closed. Government buildings locked down. State representatives were temporarily relocated to secured facilities. Lawmakers were urged not to return home, because Vance Bolter hadn't just disappeared. He had taken fear with him. The terror wasn't just in what he had done. It was in what he hadn't done yet. And that's exactly what made him so dangerous. Bolter had trained for the aftermath. Investigators would later find evidence in his garage. roadmaps, food rations, a cache of burner phones, prepaid gas cards, and a collapsible camping bed. He had escape kits hidden in different locations, each prepared for a fast exit. One of those kits was missing. That's where the trail led next. Day two of the manhunt brought a critical break. A farmer near Green Isle, a small rural township in Sibley County, reported a suspicious SUV parked in a clearing behind his property. The vehicle was partially obscured under a camo tarp, branches arranged to break the silhouette. It matched the description, dark-colored. Light bars inside the grill. Police decal residue still visible. Authorities moved fast. Drone surveillance confirmed human heat signatures in the brush nearby. Aerial units were deployed overhead. Ground teams advanced silently, tactically, a slow push through the tall grass and pine. At 9:14 p.m., Vance Luther Bolter was found lying face down beneath a tarp, fully dressed in tactical gear. A Glock was strapped to his thigh. A loaded rifle sat beside him, but he didn't reach for either. He surrendered without a word, just placed his hands behind his head and whispered, "It's over." That was the end of his operation, but the beginning of a far more complicated investigation. Inside the vehicle, authorities recovered a second notebook, even more detailed than the one previously found. This one included alternate routes, rural addresses, backup targets. Evidence suggested he was planning a second wave. Not just political figures, but doctors, educators, journalists, and activists. Some names were underlined twice. Some had addresses in Wisconsin, Iowa, even South Dakota. This wasn't spontaneous violence. It was interstate terror, mapped, timed, and fueled by a belief system that convinced him every death was justified. During interrogation, Bolter invoked his rights. He didn't speak. Not for 48 hours. Then, in a moment of apparent self-righteous calm, he said one sentence to a federal agent. "They're not victims. They were obstacles." That was his mindset. These weren't people. They were ideas, symbols, that he had been programmed to destroy. Through years of ideological manipulation, he had learned to see dissent not as disagreement, but as danger. When I visited Green Isle days later, I stood in that field. The grass was still bent where he had laid. The tape was still fluttering in the wind. And I thought about how close we came, how one more day might have meant one more killing. One more name crossed off the list. And the most haunting realization? No one saw him leave the city. No surveillance footage captured his escape. No gas stations reported suspicious activity. For nearly 2 days, he moved in the shadows of a system built on the assumption that threats were obvious faces. But Bolter didn't. He wore our face. Trust, authority, righteousness. And that's what let him move through us unnoticed. Caught, yes, but only after the damage was done. And while the courtroom would soon follow, the question still hung heavy in the air. How many more are watching, learning, waiting? Because Bolter may have been caught, but the machine that built him is still running. Chapter 8, America's Evangelical Time Bomb. In the weeks after Vance Luther Bolter was captured, Minnesota tried to return to normal. Flags were lowered. Candlelight vigils were held. The Capitol steps were lit with names and faces. Melissa and Mark Hortman, honored as leaders and community anchors. Senator John Hoffman, still recovering, gave a brief but emotional statement about unity, fear, and faith in the democratic process. His wife Yvette stood beside him, walking with a cane. They were lucky to be alive. But beneath the solemn tributes and speeches, something remained unsettled. Something that went beyond security footage and ballistics reports. It was a question that echoed in every interview I conducted, every hallway I walked through, every small-town sheriff's office I sat in. How did this happen here? And the answer no one wanted to say out loud was this. Because it was meant to. Not by one man, but by a movement. A slow-building, untraceable manipulation of American identity. Disguised as religion, framed as patriotism, fueled by isolation, resentment, and fear. Bolter's act of terror was not a glitch. It was the byproduct of years of unchecked radicalization. The kind that doesn't show up in mass protests or riots, but in YouTube recommendations, Telegram groups, pulpit whispers, and men's prayer meetings that gradually turn into gun range strategy sessions. This isn't about Christianity. It's about Christian nationalism, a dangerous distortion of faith that confuses scripture with supremacy, that claims moral authority while plotting political violence. The ideology Bolter believed in wasn't isolated. It was structured, shared, reinforced. He wasn't a lone wolf. He was a disciple. And what makes this moment so fragile is that he's not alone. According to recent Homeland Security assessments, threats tied to Christian nationalist extremism have risen over 300% in the past 5 years. Hundreds of self-styled militias now operate under banners that mix crosses with colonial flags. Sermons calling for holy war are broadcast on encrypted streams. Churches with 30 members quietly hold weapons trainings under the guise of safety teams. There are no official uniforms, no open calls to arms, just scripture twisted, patriotism poisoned, identity reprogrammed. Bolter's notebook wasn't just a kill list. It was a belief system, and belief is hard to ban. That's what makes this so much more than a criminal case. The legal system can charge him with murder, attempted murder, weapons violations, and domestic terrorism. He will likely face the death penalty under federal charges. His trial, if it goes to court, will become a landmark. But the court can only convict a man. It can't convict a movement. And that's where we're left. Because as a journalist, I've covered political violence before. I've seen ideology used as a weapon. But this case was different. It wasn't loud. It wasn't messy. It was quiet, clean, executed like a sacred ritual, with confidence, with certainty, with the unwavering belief that God had signed off on the bloodshed. That's the most terrifying manipulation of all. Not just the ability to deceive others, but the ability to deceive yourself so completely that murder becomes ministry. Bolter believed he was righteous. And unless we confront the systems that nurtured that belief, there will be another Bolter, and another, because this time bomb is still ticking, and it doesn't need orders to go off. It just needs silence.